As I said, I went up to Deerfield and looked over the plant, and it wasn't much of a plant. There was one building, which was kind of a combination of a little warehouse and an open shed under which the block equipment was set up. The machinery had obviously not been used in some time. It had all gone rusty. The little warehouse had about 40 bags of cement in it, which when I tested them turned out to be hard as a rock. They'd just been sitting there and gathering moisture. The property itself had weeds and growth, bushes, what have you, on it, taller than I was. In short, it was a little business that had gone to seed. As I found out later, Wilbur Kretz's brother-in-law had been the original manager who was supposed to get it set up and going, and he just didn't have any interest in it. He would go up occasionally and look it over and go back and go to bed in Fort Lauderdale. He just didn't care for it. I was, in my own mind, about to go back to Hart and say thanks, but I just don't think there's any future there. This town of Deerfield was a sleepy town. I'd been told it was strictly a farming town. There wasn't any other industry there. And I just felt that there wasn't any future there. But I decided to go to talk to Wilbur Kretz and get his point of view. And he said, there is a possibility of making a modest living out of it for you. He said, if it were me, I would suggest going to Hart and asking him to give you enough wherewithal to add a little lumber or building materials part to it so that it would be not just limited to making concrete blocks. Said then it might possibly be worth your while to go up there. So I did that. I went back to Hart, and he hesitated and mumbled, and I could see this wasn't a part of his game plan. And he said, well, if you want to put some other materials in there, he said, you'd have to have some money. And he said, I'm not putting any more money in it. If you want to, how much money do you think it would take to get it set up? And I said, well, it would take at least $6,000 to buy some lumber and other materials to get a minimum inventory started and to build a small warehouse and office to house it in. They said, if you want to go down and talk to the president of the Broward Bank, Mr. Camp, see if he'll loan you the money, then you can use that money to buy whatever you want. He said, I've got some old second-hand doors and windows and a few odds and ends of nails and things like that in my warehouse. He said, I'll send those up too. So I went down to see J.D. Camp, and I could see he was not too thrilled about the idea. And when it came to the idea of securing the note, he was even less thrilled when thinking of in terms of an inexperienced young guy like myself being the signer of the note. He said, if you take this note back to Mr. Hart and get him to co-sign it, then I'll loan you the $6,000. Well, I took it back to Hart, and he hemmed and hawed and backed and filled, but he finally saw there was no way out, so he reluctantly agreed to co-sign the note. So I had my $6,000 to have as my starting capital. And I thought I'd better get some lumber in here or I won't be called a lumber yard. So I arranged to buy a carload of 1x8 tongue and groove sheathing, and a carload of 2x4 random length yellow pine. And that used up most of that $6,000. Well, the other odds and ends came up in a truck, couple of truckloads from Hart's office. And we had to build a warehouse, so he sent up one of his foremen, George Davis. And George, I'd already made out a plan of what I thought I needed in the way of a lumber shed with a little space on one end enclosed that would be called an office and an enclosed warehouse for things that were perishable that shouldn't be out in the open-ended shed. And in record time, we had that warehouse put up. We hired some black fellows in the neighborhood to come over and help, and he had one or two laborers who had used to work for Hart came over and helped put the warehouse up. So I got my first idea of that I was in some kind of a foreign country when George used to call me Eddie, which I was known as down in the Hart Company. Well, the black fellows heard him call me Eddie, and somebody in the recount of it called me Mr. Elliot, or Mr. Ellick. That was their version of Eddie. So from then on, I was Mr. Eddie, or Mr. Elliot, or Mr. Ellick. Had a hard time living that one down. So we had to have a crew to run the block plant. Well, I was out there one day kind of cleaning up the block plant, and this old black fellow comes by, and he said, are you going to make blocks? And I said, yes, that's my plan. He said, well, I used to work with this man who was here before. I know how to make blocks. And I said, well, okay, come on, I'll hire you. He says, and my brother-in-law, Chick, worked with me too, and he knows how to make them. I said, all right, fine, bring him in. So this was Sam Mackin, was the name of this man. And they called him Poor Sam. I didn't know until a long time after that why they called him Poor Sam. Poor, in the black jargon, means thin. So he was Poor Sam Mackin, and Chick, his brother-in-law, was Chick Coleman, Henry Coleman. Well, Henry was one of my most faithful employees for many, many years. Sam kind of wandered in and out a few years later, and I lost track of him. But Chick stuck with it, and he was working with me many, many years later until the day he died. The third member of the crew was somebody that Sam knew, a young fellow about 18 years old by the name of Buck Ross. So I hired him. Well, we needed one more man, needed four men to operate this thing, so Buck brought his stepfather along, Charlie Smith. Charlie was kind of a fat fella and not too ambitious, but we gave him the job that didn't require too much thinking or too much ambition. Sam was the cutoff man. He was the man that stood by the mold box as the mix came up from the mixer, which was down slightly below ground level. And it came up, the mix came up a conveyor belt into a hopper, and Sam, the lead man of the crew, would pull the mud down into a mold box which had a pallet in the bottom of it, a removable pallet. And he would press his foot on a lever, and that would vibrate the mud, and it would go down into the mold box and stop on top of this pallet. And when he had the whole block formed, he would have a striker pan that would cut off the top of it and make it square on top. He then would pull a lever, and that would eject the block, pushing it up out of the mold box. And the takeoff man, who was Buck Ross, then would take it away from the mold box and store it on a rack, which was movable. When we had 48 blocks stored on these racks, then Charlie Smith would bring a portable lift over, and hydraulic lift, hand-operated, and run it underneath the rack and move the rack outdoors onto a concrete strip, which was a drying strip. It had to be out in the open, because concrete blocks have to be cured for a total of 30 days before you're able to use them. For the first several days, we stored them under the shed roof so that the sun wouldn't dry them out too fast. Then when we would run out of space, then we would move them outdoors onto this concrete strip. Well, we ran our pilot run, and it worked out okay. The blocks weren't too bad. And as a matter of fact, we had gotten the operation going, the pilot run, a little earlier than we had the warehouse built, so that we made some of our own blocks for our own warehouse, the foundation. And those blocks are still there today. Good and solid and hard as flint. We used the old cement that was in these hard-packed bags in the warehouse. We found by opening them up inside that outer hard pack, there was still good cement. We just doubled up the use of the cement so that we didn't have to waste it. The next problem was getting some customers. This was in March in 1946, by the way. 1947, rather. The first full month of operation was the month of March. And our first customer came about in this way. We were out there making our first runs of concrete blocks, and we saw a black man come walking past the yard down here on Railroad Avenue, South Railroad Avenue, which is where we were located, right on the railroad, south of Hillsborough Boulevard. And he came walking by and looking very curious, as though he wondered, what's going on here? Well, a little bit later, he came walking back the other way, still looking. Well, he kept on going. A little bit later, he came walking back south again. Well, this time he stopped, and he came over, and he said, are you making blocks there? And I said, yes, we are. I said, they're for sale. Would you like to buy some? And he said, well, I might. He says, I'm fixing to build a little house over here, and I think I'm going to need some blocks. So I said, fine, we'd love to have you as our customer. Well, it turned out to be Aubrey Jones, who owned a little grocery store on the other side of the railroad tracks and down about a block. And Aubrey became our first customer. And Aubrey not only was our first customer, he was our customer and a good customer for all his years until he died. He died a tragic death many years later when he was killed by two bandits or two thieves who came in his store to rob him. They shot him with a shotgun when he refused to give them any money. But he was a wonderful man, a very honest person, and a very smart man, too, as one of the smartest Negroes I've ever known, and was very careful in his business management. He had built, over the years, many rental units, little houses or apartments, and his crowning project was a two-story apartment house, all of concrete blocks, that he built over in on Southwest 3rd Avenue. And he was very well thought of and very well liked in the black section over there. I decided I had better go start looking for customers, because you just can't wait for people to come to you. I got a sprinkling of people here and there when they learned that we had a small operation down there. And the closest lumberyard was in Pompano Lumber Company, about 6 miles away, and on the other side in Del Rey, about 10 miles away, there was a lumberyard. So it seemed that we were going to be able to fulfill a need in this little town of Deerfield Beach. Gradually, a few farmers came in and bought a few things for their farming operations. And we met a couple of local carpenters who were doing remodeling and that sort of thing. But I was really looking for a good, solid contractor. Well, I asked around, I found out that the most successful contractor and the biggest one in the area was a man called Louis Zimmerman up in Boca Raton. So I decided I would take the bull by the horns and go up and meet him and introduce myself. I went up one day, went to his place. He owned a bar up there as well as a two-story store building. He lived up on the second floor. I went up to see him and I introduced myself. And he was a big, red-faced Dutchman. And I'd been told that he used to like his schnapps pretty good. Well, I caught him on a bad day because he was very gruff with me, and he said right up front, he says, "Is that operation down there that Bill Hart is starting up?" I said, "Well, yes, Mr. Hart is, he has an interest in it, but I'm the manager, and I'm the one who has to make it go." They say, he said, "If Bill Hart is connected with that, I'm not having anything to do with it. Goodbye." And he ushered me out the door ceremoniously, and that was that. Well, that really shot me down. But I remembered that someday I had to have another go at that. Had another customer, one of my early customers, a black man by the name of Malachi Dean. He was a farmer, small farmer, and he evidently had had a good farming season. He decided to build a new house right across the railroad tracks and down a little bit, a couple of blocks. And he came over and he had a big smile. He had three or four gold teeth up front there, big smile, almost knocked your eyes out with the reflection of the sun on those gold teeth. And he said, "I want to buy some of your blocks. I want to buy some other things. I'll buy all my things from you. I'm going to build this house." Well, it turned out to be a nice, modern CBS house, the nicest one in the black section. Up to that point, they were all more or less little wooden cottages, some of them really hovels, just hardly nothing but packing crates over there. So we furnished all the materials, and I said, "Boy, that's what I need, somebody who's building a nice house and is going to buy all the materials from me." Well, we got up into the middle of the summer, and the house is about half finished, and he came to me one day, and he said, "I'm going to be a little slow in paying you." He said, "I've run out of money," but he says, "I'm going to start farming in September, and I'll pay you then." I said, "Well, all right, sounds okay, I'll go along with that. But what I didn't know was that he had spent all of his money. He'd had a good season farming last winter, but he'd spent all his money that he had up to this point. He was out of money. Well, what little money he had left was just to get started farming in September, and he wouldn't be taking anything out of the ground, let alone getting any money, until the first of the year. Well, it turned out that his next farming season, the one coming up, was a bad one, in which he lost money, and he very nearly went broke. Well, I, in the meantime, had given him credit so that he could finish the house, but I could not get any money out of him. Well, from then on, it was a constant battle, and I would go out on my little collection days to try to collect money that was owed me, and that would usually be on Saturday afternoon after I closed up. And I would always visit him, and I'd say, Malachi, now it's about time you gave me a payment. Oh, I haven't got any money, he said, his big toothy smile coming out at me like, well, you crazy white man, where'd you get the idea I'd have any money? I'm farming now. Well, to make a long story short, he took 6 years to pay me, but he did. He paid me off, but boy, was it a long, tough battle to collect that money from him. But here again, Malachi stuck with me, and he was a customer. Didn't buy a whole lot in his later years, but he was still a customer right up to the day he died, which was just last year. My first year's sales, first full year in our fiscal year, we had set up to run from April 1st to March 31st, and incidentally, we've stuck with that all these years. We still use that as our fiscal year. My first year's sales were $90,000. And a fair amount of that was material that I sold to Hart. Hart was still building one project in Fort Lauderdale, Parkview Apartments. And he needed the blocks. Blocks were scarce then. So I hauled all his blocks to him from our block plant, sold them to him, delivered in Fort Lauderdale for 18 cents a piece. So he was helpful in that respect, that he bought some materials from me. But I couldn't sell him much else. He was still closely associated with Gate City Lumber and Supply in Fort Lauderdale. That first year, 90,000 sales, our net profit was about 13,000. Now, I had gone into this operation as general manager, president and general manager. I had no equity. I had no money to put in it. But my working arrangement was a modest salary of $45 a week plus 25% of the profit. Well, I said to Emily, this is going to be tough, but let's see what we can do. We had a small mortgage, a $55 a month mortgage on this little house that we had built, Fort Lauderdale, that had to be paid every month. But she took it good-heartedly and was a good sport, and she was very economical, and we managed to practically live on that $45 a week, feeding our little family of four. That was being very economical, but it showed what could be done if you had to. Well, by the end of the first year, when we found the accountant found that we had showed a net profit of $13,000, I had earned 25% of that, and I decided rather than take it in cash, we had built up a fairly good cash reserve, that I would buy 25% of the stock instead. And Hart says, sure, that suits me. And I could see right then he was not long for that business. He couldn't see too much of a future in it. So I purchased with my 25%, which was about 32 $3,250, I believe, yes, $3,250. I bought 25% of the stock and had a few dollars in cash left that I took as my 25% of the earnings. Well, now I had an equity in the business. Well, later that year, Mr. Hart called me up and he said, I'm getting out of Deerfield Builder Supply. He said, I've decided that I want to devote my time and effort someplace else. Well, he hadn't put much effort in it because he'd left it strictly up to me. And I think he was kind of surprised we were still in business. I forgot to mention that another customer who really helped pull us through that first summer was Cossie Lyons, who was one of the largest farmers in the area. And I got word of his need for materials through a barber that I had my hair cut one day in Boca Raton and went out to see him, and he became excellent customer. He bought at one point about all the partition blocks I could make, and a lot of regular blocks and a carload of cement and a lot of other miscellaneous material, and he was excellent pay, so I really appreciated his support. Anyway, Mr. Hart says, I've decided to trade off my equity in Deerfield Builder Supply to Wilbur. We still have some properties and assets that even after we split up last year, we still have these in common, and we've decided to not have any joint assets. And I'm going to trade off my equity in Deerfield Builder Supply to Wilbur, and he's going to trade me something else. So that was the end of Mr. Hart. Well, Wilbur, I'd always had a good relationship with Wilbur, so I was happy with this arrangement. And Wilbur said, I'm not going to interfere with you. It's your baby to run up there. But he said, I'm going to notify my purchasing agent, who's George Jones, to see what he can buy from you. Now, you have to be competitive, but anything that you can sell us where we can save money, we'll buy from you. Well, I got together with George, and they were building new houses out in the islands in Fort Lauderdale. And since we were still living in Fort Lauderdale at that time, I drove a truck home every night with the idea of bringing in to the yard any materials that we didn't have or that I had taken orders for the day before. This went on for 7 years, by the way, as long as we lived in Fort Lauderdale. It allowed me to keep my inventory down. It was kind of a mail order setup, if you will. Anyway, George and I got together, and we started furnishing doors and millwork, moldings, paneling, plywood, things of that kind. And he would give me an order the night before, and I would go down and pick them up at wholesale houses, deliver them directly to the job, and then proceed on to Deerfield to spend the rest of the day. Now that took me away from Deerfield too long, but it was necessary, since it was important to have a good customer like this. Sometimes it would be middle of the morning by the time I had picked things up and delivered them and gotten into Deerfield. My early suppliers were not that happy to sell me, because the word had gotten out, this is when Hart was still in the operation, the word had gotten out that Hart controlled the company, and they figured that he was going to use this as a means of buying materials at wholesale. Well, it never turned out that way, because about all I ever sold him was concrete blocks, so it didn't really mean that he was cutting out buying from his prime supplier, who was Gate City Lumber and Supply. Well, he had told me early on to go over to Gate City Sash and Door, that's the wholesale division of Gate City Lumber and Supply, and see if you can buy from them through their wholesale division. Well, I went in and asked to see the head man there, who turned out to be a man by the name of Herb Cheney. He was a short, very gruff man. I was a little worried about my confrontation with him, how that would turn out. So they ushered me into his office, and he said, "Deerfield Builder Supply, that's that little lumber yard that just started up in Deerfield," he said, "that Bill Hart owns, isn't it?" I said, "Yes, he has an equity in it, but I'm the owner, I'm the manager, and the president of the company, and it's my responsibility to operate it. He has very little to do with it." And he said, "Well, Bill Hart needn't think he's going to use that to buy his stuff at wholesale." And on he went. He was really worked up over that. So the sum and substance of it, he finally calmed down, and I guess saw that I was for real, and he said, "All right, I'm going to open up an account for you, but you better not miss any payments." And he said, "If I catch you running stuff into Hart's jobs there and we lose business over in the retail side, that's it." Well, that never happened. So that was the beginning of a good relationship. And as things kept developing, Herb Cheney became a very good friend of mine. And he ended up having a lot of confidence in us, and we turned out to be a very good customer of his. Another company that I wanted to buy from was a wholesale company selling wholesale lumber, millwork, and plywood, and that was Forest Products Corporation. Well, I went down to see them to open an account, and they turned me down flat. They weren't having anything to do with me. They were not mean about it, but they just said, "No, we're not going to open an account for you at this time." Well, it took me a whole year, but finally, when the word got around that I was for real and that Hart, it was not a dummy outfit for Hart, well, then they all began to loosen up and took me on. The other of the major wholesalers that took me on was Peninsula Supply, and they sold building materials, roofing, metal products, nails, and so forth. And I had no problem with that. Mr. Oliver, the owner of that company, was willing to take me on. And here again, I developed a very fine working relationship with him. And his treasurer of his company was Ed Heimberger, who I got to know through Navy circles. And I think Ed helped smooth the way for our getting in there as a customer. I remember learning one of my most important lessons from Peninsula Supply. I had started out this business with the idea that I was going to pay my bills promptly. In other words, if standard terms were purchase materials, we'll say, in the month of June, and they were due and payable by the 10th of July. And I was determined from what my father had always advised me back in those tough days in the Depression. He said, "Always discount your bills if you possibly can." He said, "That could be your profit, the discount that you earn." So I remembered that, and I said, "That's what I'm going to do." But this early time, maybe in the middle of the summer of 1947, my money came up short, and I didn't have the money to pay Peninsula Supply by the 10th. Well, on the 12th, I had a letter from Peninsula signed by Ed Heimberger saying, "You missed your discount. It's due and payable. Get in and pay it or make arrangements." So I hopped right in there, and I said, I'm sorry. I slipped up there, and what can I do to make amends?" And he says, "Oh, don't worry about that." He said, "That's a form letter that I send out." And he said, "It's mainly for plumbers. We have a lot of trouble with plumbers getting them to pay their bills promptly. And they just, those letters go out to everybody whose payment isn't in by the 10th. But even with that explanation, it taught me a lesson. And from then on, I never missed a discount. Maybe years later, we might have missed one every 5 years, but it would have been an oversight. A bill got mislaid or something like that. But from then on, it was discount your bills without fail. We still do that. As a result, we have developed one of the best credit ratings around for any company. Not many companies are that prompt paying. In the summer of 1954, remember Deerfield Builder Supply has been in business for 7 years now. We've had a profit, not always a huge profit, but a fair profit every year. I take out rather modest salaries. I'm not trying to skim the company or get rich quick or anything like that. I take out what we need to live on and let the profits and surplus go in to help the company grow, and that has been my policy from the very beginning. And we're still 39 years later, we're still doing that, but to a lesser extent. We try to pay fair salaries, not only to ourselves, but to our employees, and pay bonuses if we're making money, which we have every year. But make sure that the earnings are plowed back into the company so that the company will not stand still. It will be always growing. I went to Wilbur and indicated to him that I would like to buy him out. He had sold me 25%. No, he hadn't sold me any stock at this point. He still owned 75% of it. I had just the 25%. Wilbur was reluctant to sell out. He was happy with the way it was going. He was taking dividends out of the company. His main thrust, his main business in Fort Lauderdale was in building. He was the first condominium builder, they call them co-ops then, in Fort Lauderdale, and he had developed an excellent reputation in building co-ops and heavy construction of that type. He had almost gotten out of single-family housing. The profit out of Deerfield Builder Supply was really very modest compared to what he was making in his construction company. But realizing that it was important to me to own the company, 100% ownership, he said, "I don't want to get out. I'm very happy with the way things are going, but," he said, "I realize that you want to have it, so I'm going to sell out to you." So he devised a system in which I had very little cash, but in the meantime, Emily and I had prepaid our mortgage on our little house on Northeast 15th Avenue and had paid it out and owned it free and clear. So Wilbur knew this, and he suggested that we trade him that free and clear house. We agreed on a price. That price worked out to the value of 25% of the stock of our company. So we traded him the house for 25% of Deerfield Builder Supply and arranged to have the company buy back his other 50% of the stock. So the company gave him a series of notes, and over a period of a few years paid him off, and then by virtue of our owning 50% of the stock and that no further stock was outstanding, that the stock, the rest of it had been called in, we now own 100% of the company. So when we gave up our house in Fort Lauderdale, that meant we didn't have any place to live. And we felt it was just about time we moved to Deerfield, because we were becoming more involved in local affairs and not only in business, but in social events and social organizations, Chamber of Commerce and other things of that kind. So in the meantime, I had hired Frank Kyle, who had lived in Newport, Kentucky, and had a plumbing business up there. But because of ill health, it had to sell out and move to Florida. Well, he had bought a house over on the beach on Northeast 1st Street, 1949, Northeast 1st Street. But he had recovered from his illness and wanted to do something, wanted to go to work. Well, he'd become a customer of mine, so I knew him in that sense. He came to me one day and he said, "I'd like to go to work for you." And I said, "But you've been a substantial businessman in your own right. Working for me, what would you do?" And he said, "I'd like to be an outside salesman. You need an outside salesman to go out and get the business for you." Well, I said, "Fine, I agree to that." So we made a deal. He came to work as an outside salesman. He went right out, and he wasn't bashful. He went right up and down the line, getting customers and selling materials. And he did that for a couple of years until his hip went bad. He had a hip socket problem, which is fairly common today. And it was very painful, and he got to the point where he couldn't get around. So we arranged to have him come inside and be our bookkeeper. Well, he wasn't a bookkeeper as such, but he did a pretty good job of it. And the main thing was he was very interested in the business and wanting to make it prosper. And he was very helpful in being a seasoned businessman himself to give me good advice from time to time. Well, my point was that he had this house over on the beach next to Sloan's, and when he found out that we were moving out of Fort Lauderdale, he said, "Why don't you buy my house?" He said, "My wife doesn't like Lou Sloan, and she is not going to live there any longer. She's put her foot down." And he said, "We're going to move out of that house. We're going to buy a condominium someplace, or a co-op we were then." And he said, "I'll make it easy for you." He said, "You can buy that house with practically no money down, and you can get a mortgage on it, and I'll take back a second mortgage." And that's what we did. I think we paid him $1,000 down, paid $13,000 for the house, paid $1,000 down, got a mortgage at First Federal to the office in Pompano, and gave him a second mortgage for the rest. Well, we had him paid off in about 2 years, and the First Federal mortgage we had paid off in about 5 years, so we were out of debt there. In the meantime, our business was prospering. It was getting a little better all the time, but still not taking off. We looked to the south and heard all the stories of great prosperity and building down in Fort Lauderdale. Fort Lauderdale was just booming. So we were hoping that it was going to come to us before long, but it was very slow in coming. In 1955, we'd been moved to Deerfield just 1 year. I was approached by some of the local people who asked me if I would run for city commission. Well, I wasn't too keen on it because I felt I needed all the time that I had to keep our business going and make it prosper. But I relented and I ran for commission. How they conned me into it was the local politics were somewhat a line between beach and town, and all furthermore between the liquor industries and the Baptists. The Baptists were very much the teetotalers. And there was still very much cleavage between the black and the white community. Well, they came to me and said, the word is out that the liquor industries are going to run one of the black bar owners over here for the commission, and we are faced with the possibility of having a black bar owner as a commissioner. We are just are not going to have that. We want you to run for it and keep him out. Well, I fell for that. It turned out later that that was just a myth. But there were only two of us running. We ran unopposed. Emory Butler, who I had a very high regard for. He was a local farmer, very fine Christian gentleman. So he and I ran and were unopposed and were elected as city commissioners for two, we were called councilmen at that time. And he served for part of a term and resigned for press of business or something else. Anyway, I stayed on and served my 2 years. It was an interesting experience. One of the principal accomplishments that we had during my two-year term was that we changed the form of government from the council weak mayor system, in which the mayor, Barney Chalker, had been the perennial mayor, was elected separately, and then five councilmen were elected as councilmen. And the mayor had a vote, but he was like the chairman of the council. Well, Howard Little was the prime mover in getting it changed, and he proposed the idea of the commission city manager form of government, which was a more modern, up-to-date method. So we got the charter rewritten.